universe is full of magical things, patiently waiting for our wits to grow sharper. These are the words of Eden Philpotts, and since he wrote them in 1918, our senses have certainly got sharper. The Hubble Space Telescope introduced us to the idea of dark energy and billions upon billions of galaxies far beyond our own that we didn't know even existed. Today, thanks to the work of Thomas Dalton, we regularly look at atoms through powerful microscopes, even though their existence had been subject to skepticism since they were first suggested by the ancient Greek scholars Democritus and Leucippus about 2,500 years ago. And if you've ever seen an olive grove shimmer in the breeze but didn't know how to explain it, you'd know that magic is real. It makes you think, what else is out there that we don't yet fully understand? What else are our wits not quite sharp enough to comprehend? And just like Democritus and Leucippus, what is it that we may just already know but are not quite ready to face just yet? I'm Chris Brock, and this is Conversations on Living, a podcast about how to be well, do well, and live well. This week, I'm talking about PSI, which is the collective scientific moniker for the parapsychological functions of the mind. That is, those things that we think might exist, but which come with so much baggage that most people are afraid to even touch them. I'm talking about extrasensory perception, clairvoyance, telepathy, and other things surrounded by so much cultural woo-woo that it must surely be nonsense, right? Well, science's wits are beginning to grow sharper, and there is an increasing amount of rigorous research happening in this area. And who among us wouldn't admit that there are things out there that we just can't explain? Who hasn't had a weird experience? Deja vu, a gut feeling that has come true. Who knew who was calling before they answered the phone? Seen things, heard things. Well, there may be more to it than we think. To explore this with me, I'm joined by a friend of the podcast, Kim Forrester. She's a holistic therapist, the host of the Eudaimonia podcast, and the author of Infinite Mind, a book all about psi in its many expressions. And she believes that if we get quiet and pay attention to these phenomena that we might otherwise dismiss out of hand, we might discover that they're actually trying to tell us something. You can find more information about Kim and her book at infinitemindbook.com, and her home on the internet is kimforrester.com. That's Forrester with two R's. She's also on Instagram, I am Kim Forrester, and all these links will of course be in the show notes. And before we get started, just a quick word about Headliner. I always mention them at the beginning of every podcast because they support me with their service. And it's a great service. I use it to create audiograms. So they are those little graphics with clips of audio from the podcast and also moving waveforms or captions. You've probably seen the kind of thing. And if you're a host of a podcast, you should definitely check it out because it's the most powerful and easy way to create them. They're at headliner.app. And also another word about Plane. So Plane is a game that is created by a friend of the podcast, Krish Shrikumar. And you are charged with creating a beautiful island, nurturing it, growing trees, just bringing it to life using the power of mindfulness. And it teaches simple relaxation, meditation, and mindfulness techniques using the power of video games. So definitely check it out. That's Plane, P-L-A-Y-N, and that's at www.plane.co. And just a quick request from me, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And also check out my newsletter at www.conversationsonliving.com. And of course, you can find out all about the other episodes of the podcast there, my writing, my meditations, my books, all that kind of stuff. And if you want to carry on the conversation, you can find the Facebook group, just search for conversationsonliving.com. Now, without any further wiffle waffle from me, this conversation with Kim. I love Kim, and I'm so happy to have her back on the show. So thank you, Kim, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. Cheers. So Kim, thank you for coming back on the show. How are you doing?
Oh, Chris, it's great. It's a very intense time in my life at the moment, but I think it's a very intense time in everyone's life. So it's, I come to you very human, very vulnerable, and really very much looking forward to having a nice deep chat with you today.
Yeah, the world is certainly a strange place at the moment. And, you know, they say that pressure makes diamonds, don't they? So, you know, hopefully we can all... When we finally get some kind of routine back and we know where we are as a world, maybe we can come out a little bit stronger. But yeah, it's tough and challenging, but we get by, don't we, day to day, I suppose.
What I've found quite wonderful, certainly in the way that I'm living my life in this uncertainty, is that, well, we're all in it together. And I think there's a wonderful opportunity for us straight away to reach out to one another, to be there together in our fragility, yeah, and our vulnerability.
Yeah, I think it was very much like that at the beginning, especially here in the UK. There was a lot of kind of goodwill to people, and you saw it all across Europe. You know, there were videos from Italy. I remember seeing a policeman serenading people who were locked in their apartments down these kind of Italian alleyways and all this kind of stuff. But then I think people got very tired, and suddenly there started to become, you know, a bit of angst. I really wish we could hold on to this idea that something good can come out of this in a kind of spiritual kind of healing kind of way, a recognition of each other's humanity or something, and a kind of a motivation to do something good. I don't know, but we shall see. I mean, we just got to kind of keep doing the work, haven't we, and keeping up the good fight, as it were.
Absolutely. Maybe it's yet to come.
Yeah, we shall see. But we spoke last time. You're a holistic therapist, the host of the Eudaimonia podcast, and you're also the author of a book called Infinite Mind, which we touched on, I think, in our last conversation, but you've just re-released it. And as I kind of mentioned before, I'm really interested in this whole kind of Jungian idea that below our kind of conscious mind, there is a kind of another voice. You know, one of my favorite quotes of all time, and I remember the first time I came across it, I was on a train on my way into London, and graffitied on the wall was this phrase, and it said, beneath the threshold of consciousness, everything was seething with life. And I went home, I thought, that's amazing. Wow, that's really intense. I went home and Googled it, and it's Carl Jung, the psychologist. And, you know, there's this idea, he was very much into dreams and things like this, that, you know, that there is a kind of inner wisdom. And when we can peel back all the layers that we kind of accumulate and get attached to our ego, you know, this kind of image of who we think we are, attached to our suffering and attached to our programming, all that kind of stuff, there is a kind of intrinsic wisdom. And your book also talks about kind of getting messages from a kind of wiser, or, well, I don't want to necessarily use the word wiser, but from another place. And it talks about this kind of whole field of psi, which is PSI, isn't it?
And that's right, yeah.
And it's kind of the kind of kind of documentable or unquantifiable field of, how would you describe it, sort of?
Well, I would say previously unquantifiable. Yeah. certainly when our science became very materialistic, and our psychology became very materialistic, with Descartes and with Newton 300-400 years ago, the whole idea of an experience that sits outside Newtonian physics, right, was pushed to one side, and it was left to the mystics to understand that or to explain that. And certainly, you know, through the Enlightenment, as people became more attached to the idea of being seen as rational and reasonable and intelligent and educated, these experiences that most of your listeners would have personally had at some point, but these experiences became regarded as antithetical to the idea of being seen as reasonable and rational and intellectual. Thankfully, in the last 50 years in particular, okay, so probably 150 years, people have been trying to study things like telepathy, or, you know, psychic visions, remote viewing. But those experiments were, you know, fraught with errors and psychological biases and fraud. So, you know, the skeptical had every reason to sort of defy any of those results that were coming through, say, in the early 20th century. Thankfully, the last 50 years, there has been a rise of very robust empirical science that is showing incredible evidence that there is another part of our consciousness, there is another part of our psyche, there is a depth to our universe that allows us as animals, as beings, to sometimes know some things that are beyond space-time. And it has got to the point now, the science is new and it's emerging. So it's not widely known, it's not widely accepted in the public. It will filter through in 150 years time, we'll be having completely different conversations. But right now, those who know, including skeptics who look at the data, know that if we are to hold psychic ability, psi, to the same standard as any other scientific theory out there, then it has been, I use the word proven, right, to the standard that any science proves anything. It is very robust, the data and the evidence behind this being true and real, and within the confines of how we understand the universe works.
There is, it has a bit of baggage, doesn't it? When you talk about clairvoyance, for example, mm-hmm. telepathy, people immediately think of crystal balls and, lace my palm with silver and all this kind of stuff. And, it sounds a bit kind of hokey. Mm-hmm. And certainly I'm a bit skeptical. Like I mentioned before, I'd like to call or think of myself as a kind of realist who believes in magic. So I believe life is magical, but I'm also, raised on science and what we kind of know. And I love the idea of it. I love that there's more out there. I think if someone famous, it might've been Wordsworth or someone, they said, the universe is filled with things just waiting for our senses to get sharper. Lots of things we don't understand yet. I must admit, when I hear someone talking about like clairvoyance or telepathy, I do immediately go, okay, right.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Well, there's connotation there.
Yeah.
And it's very real connotation. And the work that I'm doing, bringing science into this field of psi, it rubs people the wrong way, right? And not just skeptics who are yet to open themselves up to the evidence that's available to them, but also to those who are deeply entrenched in the spiritual world and who have bought into the stories and who are perpetuating the stories that this is a gift that comes, through me and, and only I and this special elite group of people can actually tap into this information. This is also confronting for them, because if we look at the science that is emerging, it says it's ubiquitous, it's a part of being a part of the universe, the quantum universe probably, or some kind of form of higher consciousness. We all have it. It's an aptitude, not a gift. So there is a calling and a request for over the next few generations for people on both sides of the fence to actually start adjusting the way they look at this.
Because you've used some amazing stories in your book. You talk about Winston Churchill and Conrad Hilton. You talk about the experience they've had, Conrad Hilton being the founder of Hilton Hotels, mm-hmm. and how he kind of got his big break, and that was through some kind of what was his experience? It was a kind of just deeper knowing that something was to trust his gut instinct and that kind of thing.
He would pray to God the way he do it, would pray to God and then clear his mind and wait for God to answer. That was the way he framed the, but the information would just pop into his head. Connie's hunches, they were well known.
Yeah. And then Winston Churchill, he was, when he was much younger, he was behind enemy lines in South Africa and he needed help and just happened to knock on the door of someone who would help him in the middle of nowhere, the book is filled with all kinds of examples like this. And I've had my own strange experiences. I've got quiet. I'm very much into meditation and Shinrin Yoku and stuff like that. And I remember going into the trees one day with a question and getting a very clear answer in my head, And I think you called that clairaudience, is it? Or when it came as one of your own thoughts?
It's one of the labels that is out there, absolutely. Yeah. If you hear it in your inner monologue, it's known as clairaudience.
But you've also talked about people hearing other voices, someone else's voice, like the girl who put on her seatbelt and it saved her life, one of the few times she ever wore a seatbelt. stuff like that. And it's, you know, is it our own mind playing with us? Is it our own inner kind of subconscious, or is it something out there? You know, part of, you know, people talk about the quantum field, which I'm sure drives, you know, quantum physicists up the wall.
Mad. Yeah.
But you know, is it something bigger than that, or is it just that our minds are so complex that they give us these kind of, when we get quiet or when we get into those kind of states of, I think I heard an astronaut talking about a time his spacesuit started to fill up with water and he potentially could have drowned. And people said, "Were you scared?" And he said, "No, I wasn't scared, but I had a sense of heightened awareness." That's what, because they're trained so well, you know, they don't get scared. They just, like, suddenly they're very aware. But, you know, you talked about people who knew they were about to get attacked and things like this in the book. Is it that our, you know, our subconscious mind is taking over in times like this and feeding us messages? Is that what this is all about?
Oh, I'm not the expert to, you know, be able to tell you what the mechanics of this are. And I'm certain that the researchers and those who are, you know, dedicating their daily lives to this still aren't sure of the mechanics of it. I'm happy to share what my experience of that has been in case it resonates with you and some of your listeners. For me, it seems that it is a spectrum, right? That it's not, oh, there is logical thought and then there is intuition and then there is the psi information that flows through. For me, I think there's a blurring of the boundaries between those three things. And, you know, I'm highly attuned to that gut instinct and I truly trust it when it comes through. What I have noticed is that when I'm really on the ball, when I'm about to, so I've moved to Dunedin in New Zealand and we bought a house, for instance, and the house that I'm currently sitting in that we bought, I knew I was going to get it. I knew I was going to buy it. And I knew that I was going to be the eventual winning bid, a highly competitive market here. And I knew that because I walked in the door and it was an open home and there were about 20 other people in the house. And inside, I started hissing like a cat. Like inside, just out of the blue, it was like, get out of my house. Yeah. And it was such an instinctive, it wasn't me logically going, oh, I'd really like this house and I'd like for you to, you know, bugger off so that you don't buy it. It was, I acted as if there were strangers walking through my home. And it was powerful. It was undeniable in certainty. Yeah, I couldn't question it. There was an absolute certainty to it. And that's often what I find when I know I'm dealing with something that is psi-based. Who's to say though that there isn't some kind of subconscious intuition there as well, you know, that of all the data I'd picked up over the year of looking at houses here, I knew somehow that this was going to fall in my favor. There's a blurring of lines there. Yeah,
there's I always talk about Martha Beck because she was a guest on the podcast. She's American life coach, probably doesn't do her justice, but she always talks about her spirit mule, which is basically a spirit animal, but it's her intuition. And she says, you know, notice what you notice how you feel, because that's your kind of the subconscious wisdom guiding you. You know, it's like a spirit animal, but it's like, you know, we're constantly bombarded by information, and you know, some of it is obvious, some of it's very subtle, but we're almost like pattern recognition machines. And when we can start to kind of become aware of those, you know, noticing what we notice, noticing how we're feeling about situations, then we can use it to kind of guide ourselves like a tool almost, you know, like you said, you get a feeling that something's not right, or that this is the house, or in terms of Conrad Hilton, he also put in a bid, didn't he, for his hotel, and
he got actual numbers. It was a price that he was given.
And he
go in this number.
Yeah, and he won it at auction by a very narrow margin, just because he went back and changed his bid. And it's all this kind of, you know, he really was attuned to the messages that were coming into him. Why do you think we're not more aware of this input, you know, that's coming at us? Because we're bombarded by information all the time, both internally and externally. Why are we so kind of dull to it, do you think?
Precisely because we're bombarded with information all the time. And, you know, psychology tells us that when we're an infant, we come into the world ready to absorb everything, willing to absorb everything. That's why babies are, you know, sort of staring into space. It's a sensory overload, and we absorb everything that's going on. And then over time, rather rapidly, you know, by the time we're 6 months, 9 months, 2 years old, we've already built up an idea of the information that's worthy of our attention, the information that's not. And there's an example of this that we've all had in our life. So I've been pregnant 3 times in my life, and every time you fall pregnant as a woman, all of a sudden you see pregnant women everywhere. You go out and you buy a new car, and it might be a blue Nissan, and all of a sudden you're driving down the road and you see blue Nissans everywhere. They've always been there. Pregnant women have always been there. Blue Nissans have always been there. But when you bring it into your life and it becomes pertinent to you and important to you, your conscious mind, the gatekeeper, goes, oh, that information's important. So now I'm going to notice it more. It's what, you know, clever magicians use all the time, is this unconsciousness, unconscious awareness.
Yeah, like an attention bias kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely.
I suppose you can use it to your advantage, can't you? You can train yourself to focus on opportunities, for example. I remember another example I use a lot is when I was in Vietnam and my wife and I decided to hire a scooter, you know, a moped. And Vietnam is just awash with mopeds. It's chaos, you know, especially from coming from London, where we have very strict rules and regulations about, you know, who's right away it is. And when we hired it, we said to the guy, any advice? So I think we looked it up on the internet, and they said, focus on the gap where you want to go. Don't focus on the other drivers, because if you focus on the obstacle, you'll hit the obstacle. So focus on the gap. And, you know, it's a good metaphor for, you know, focusing on where you want to go. Don't focus on all the things that get you down. Focus on the things that lift you up, you know, that kind of thing.
I'll bring you back to childhood, though. So yeah, it was a long story, but the point is that let's assume, as science is showing us, that psi information and knowing beyond space-time and knowing beyond the physical universe is inherent in every single one of us, particularly as an infant. Now, I want you to consider that a young child starts talking about how they know grandma's coming around next week, you know, without anyone knowing, or they saw something in their bedroom, or, you know what I mean? The child starts expressing what they are receiving through psi information. Now, one set of parents goes, don't talk about that. That's absolutely silly. You know, or it's evil, or that's the devil, you know, in some cases. Well, that child is going to go, well, that information is not very important to me, and it doesn't bring a very pleasant reaction. Shut it out. In other families, such as my children, incredibly attuned and attentive to information that they get through psi mechanism. And that's because whenever they said something, we'd go, oh, cool. What do you think about that? You know, when we were open to it. So that information remained important in their brain. So your original question was, you know, why do we filter it out? We filter it out. A lot of people filter it out because they've been told it's not important, it's not real, it's not, you know, it's not going to be helpful to you in life. So your brain, it's there. It's there if you want to focus on that gap. But you do have to retrain your brain to bring it back in.
That's the thing. I mean, it does require, I mean, we've all had weird experiences. I've had, you know, I meditate daily. I get, you know, relatively regularly now, images pop into my head, you know, just kind of surreal. And they're not thoughts. It's not my mind drifting to my to-do list. It's a random image that, you know, has full of metaphorical meaning. But also I've been out jogging and seen things in the sky that, you know, aren't physically there. You know, I saw a Buddha in the clouds one day, just like real as you are right now.
That's cool. Yeah.
It was cool. And I wasn't into any of this kind of stuff at all. And I remember I was out jogging with my wife and I sort of looked up and there it was, and then it went away again. And I remember getting home, we were in the kitchen drinking our water afterwards. And I said, I think I've just had a vision of a Buddha. And she was like, oh, right. I was like, yeah, that's weird. So I have no idea what it meant, if it meant anything at all. But, you know, we've all had strange experiences, heard strange things, you know, seen strange things.
Mm.
I mean, what is it? Can we use it? Can we use this? Is it something that we can kind of harness, tap into? Is it something we need to be afraid of? You know,
it can be harnessed in an incredible array of really helpful and meaningful ways, not just in our own life. The way I've experienced the psi connection that I have learned to build up and trust, it doesn't stop really rubbish things from happening in my life, right? It doesn't stop that. It does help me make better decisions about what's the healthiest path forward, what's the healthiest choice, you know, in front of me right now. Oh, the only other time I've had a reaction like I did when I bought this house, I bought another house in Sydney a couple of decades ago when we moved there, and I had exactly the same feeling. And that house doubled in price, you know, in the time that we were there, and actually set us up financially really well. So, but I followed the feeling and had a great, you know, financial outcome from that. But I want to expand it beyond the personal experience, because there are actual tests and trials underway to see if we can train firefighters to use remote viewing, to use psi information to find people inside buildings. So they walk into a smoky building, follow that gut instinct. Where can you feel? Where can you sense a human being? Can you imagine if our firefighters had that kind of tool available to them? Throughout the book, and there are many, many books about the psychic spies of the USA, and it wasn't just the USA, but during the Cold War, on both sides of the Iron Curtain, that, you know, there were countries who were actively engaging in finding people with an incredibly honed and refined aptitude for remote viewing, and they were getting all sorts of information. One of the stories in the book is about Mal Riley, who was actually told, he was doing a trial run with the US Air Force, and he was actually told to cease and desist and do not ever speak of what you've seen again. He was so accurate with what he saw.
It makes me think of, is it John Ronson? He wrote a story, The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was—
That's right. It was based on Mal Riley's group. Oh, yeah, really? Green Flame. It was, yeah.
Okay, because, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating stuff. So, I mean, it's fascinating enough for the military to take an interest in. I mean, as much as everyone likes to think, oh, this is just woo-woo nonsense, there's got to be some people taking it relatively seriously.
I believe it was Reagan, I might be wrong with that, but it was I believe it was Reagan who said, I don't care how it works, I just know that it does. And there's a fabulous book called Psychic Spies that actually runs through the whole program by a journalist. A really, really fascinating book. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think experiments were done in Nazi Germany as well, and all over the place. There are people doing this kind of thing. What was it that compelled you to write the book in the first place?
Statistics. two statistics. So I come from, you know, let's say a spiritual point of view. I wanted to be psychic at 26, and I was shocking at it, absolutely awful at, you know, anything like that. I certainly was not tapped on into the reality of the psi information and the way it works for me. Anyway, aside, the more embedded I became in this intuitive knowing that I have on occasion, the more I understood I'm not special. This isn't a gift. And then I saw two statistics. The first one is 4.6%. And this one blew my mind. In fact, I put this on a comment section online in a news article once. And of course, I was poo-pooed and laughed out the door, but it's real. 4.6% is the amount of the universe that is matter and energy. So, and that is, as human beings, that is currently all we can measure and understand, matter and energy. So 4.6 of the composition of the universe is all we know. So 95% of what is running through us, what is happening to us, what is coming from us, what is emanating between us, we don't even know where to begin. When I saw that, I went, well, what do we know? Seriously, what do we know as a species? We're running around with this complete lack of intellectual humility, claiming that we know what's possible and what's not possible. We've seen 6 minutes of a feature film, right? And we have no idea. So that was the first statistic. And the second one was a range of statistics from around the world. But it averages out to about 65% of people actually, and I use the word believe, in psychic ability. I think I've said to you in an email, in a correspondence, that it's not a matter of believing anymore, but there you go. If you put 10 people in a room, 6 or 7 of them are going to be very open to this, would have had experiences, are going to be talking about it. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because if you put 10 people together at a dinner table for a dinner party who don't know one another very well, no one's ever going to bring that up.
Yeah.
No. And I went, then there is need and there is room for a new conversation about this. And it's one where we can say to people, look, here is science. And here's an intellectual conversation that you can actually hang your hat on, right? And you can say, right, I'm going to start with the science. I'm going to start with these statistics. I'm going to start with the reality of the universe and what we know about it, and the reality of how many people have these experiences and what science is saying about it. Start there. Then you can start having the conversation with a different connotation. Then you can start having a conversation around the dinner table with an understanding that another 6 people are going to agree with you, but you don't look like a kook.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's funny, the more I think about stuff like this, the more I just look at science in general. Science is always evolving, it's always coming up with new ideas. When I was doing my diploma in Shinrin-yoku, which is forest bathing, you know, the current kind of, or the kind of prevalent thinking about forests is that all the trees are in competition with each other. But then they did more and more research, which was very at first it was kind of poo-pooed because it was a woman who did it to begin with, and she used challenging language, like she referred to some trees as kind of mother trees and things like this. But eventually she proved it using very scientific methods that trees actually work together. You know, and a forest can be considered a single organism. And even when we walk into a forest, you know, we enter into that organism. We're breathing out carbon dioxide that the trees use to kind of live, and the trees are giving us oxygen. And so we become part of that. And that makes me think of Alan Watts, which is a bit of a tangent, a bit of a leap here. But, you know, he says we don't come into this world. We come out of it, just like a wave comes out of the ocean, you know. That does make me think we're all connected. Everything is connected one way or another. Everything is energy, everything is vibration and frequency, just like you know, Tesla said, you know. And you know, when I remember when my dad had a heart attack, many years ago, I had a dream about my dad. And I never dream about my dad. I had a dream, woke up thinking that was a weird dream I had about my dad. Then the phone rang and I heard that he had a heart attack. You know, he didn't die, not that time anyway, but and then my mum has stories about when her twin sister was giving birth, she felt terribly sick, you know, had terrible sickness in it, you know, in her belly. And then the phone rang and it's like, your sister's just had a baby, you know, and all of these kind of things. We've all experienced things like this. And you know, you have to kind of think, maybe there is something going on, you know, that there are things that happen to us that are beyond kind of current explanation. And I guess that's exactly what this is all about, trying to tap into that.
Well, I'm going to take you back to the late 18th century. And France has had one of the largest number of meteorite landings in the world. But back in 1796, I think it was, or in the 1760s, a group of townsfolk went to the Académie des Sciences in Paris and said these rocks fell from the sky, and they were absolutely laughed out of the Academy. How that's impossible. We all know through the science that nothing exists beyond the sky other than the moon, because that's what science tells us. And then all the other countries around the world didn't want to be seen as kooks, you know, in this age of intellectual enlightenment. So they also decided that no, rocks falling from the sky was completely impossible. It, you know, it was a couple of decades later that they actually, that so many fell from the sky in one particular town that they figured maybe they should research it. I bring you to meditation. So I'm currently just completing a diploma in positive psychology, and it's really interesting to talk about mindfulness and meditation and how scientific it is, this you know, idea that when we take time to be mindful and present, that it is actually great for our well-being. Well, Buddhists have been telling us that for 2,000 years. But if you go back 50 years ago, when John Lennon was doing it, for instance, it was regarded as kookery. It was, oh, that's woo-woo spiritual stuff. Now, all of a sudden, it's science. Forest bathing is the same thing, you know. Oh, spiritual woo-woo stuff. Oh, now it's science. Well, that's what psi is becoming as well now. And we're in that transition now where there's a lot of psychology behind it. It is not easy for us to accept when our universe shifts, right? When our reality morphs into something else. But it is, I see psi as the next step, and consciousness as the next step. And that the science is there, the science will continue to grow and be more robust and be more prolific, better funded. And all of a sudden, my grandkids will probably be learning it in school. You know, what subject do you want to take? Well, why don't you tap in, right? Go into the forest and tap in and find out what subject is best for you. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, well, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, there's a haiku that I love. I love kind of Japanese haiku. I'm no expert by any means, but there's one that it says, the lamp wants out, cool stars enter the window frame. And it just means that, you know, when you turn the lights down, you see everything else. When, you know, when you cut out the noise, you can hear so much more. Mm-hmm. What is the purpose of your book? What are you trying to achieve with, you know, with the stories, with the explanations? You talk about the science. Is there a kind of function you're trying to, you know, a kind of need you're trying to kind of fill with this, encouraging people to explore it more?
An invitation rather than a need. I try not to, you know, I created it out of an absolute yearning to do so. And I wanted to present to the world, to those who are interested, the foundation upon which they can start accepting, acknowledging, and explaining their own experiences with an intellectual foundation. I wanted people like yourself. I've had dear friends, you know, read the book, and there are absolute skeptics come to me afterwards and say, oh, that story there, that resonated with me, that happened to me. And it's nice, it's actually truly wonderful to see people go, sort of where they accept it. All of a sudden, there's a bit of science for them, like I say, to hang, you know, to peg the whole experience on. And then they can go, oh, it was real. And then the magic of the moment can be accepted as well.
I love it because, like, you know, this stuff, you know, weird stuff happens to us. We see things. I see Buddha in the sky. You know, there are all these stories of things that have happened. And now there's science coming in to back it up. And, you know, obviously it goes back hundreds of years. But, you know, we're not machines. We're very kind of complex beings. And we have, you know, we have our religions, perhaps we have our you know, traumas, we have all our wiring and miswiring. But we're kind of urged to behave as if, you know, we're very, this is what we are, and this is how we behave, and this is what's real, and this is what's not real. Mm. And I think it's just this encouragement to explore things a little bit more, just explore, you know, something was weird. You don't have to dismiss it. You know, something happened to you that was a bit, you know, you had a strange feeling or a strange event, or you had something that just told you, you've got to do this, and you did it and it worked out brilliantly. You know, you bought the house, or, you know, you knocked on the door that was the friendly person. You know, don't dismiss it, because it happened and it's real. You know, that feeling was real, you know, and it's, I think in a way it makes us a little bit more human to even just to play with it, to explore it, you know.
Yeah, the word I would use, as I have fallen more into allowing that side of me to express itself, I would say wholeness. Yeah. There is a wholeness when we stop shutting out this deeply intuitive, and I would say deeply connected, that the information we're getting is somewhere beyond space-time, right? It is part of, it's interesting, the very beginning of the conversation, you talked about Carl Jung going inward to the wisdom. And I immediately thought, oh, no, we're going out to a super consciousness. And then I was thinking, oh, but it's the same thing. And that's what I think we have to understand, that inward is outward. If we go into the very center of who we are, we're back in the expanse of the universe, you know, so it's the same thing.
Yeah absolutely. And, you know, I've talked about, you know, reality exists for us where we experience it, and we experience it within ourselves. So the whole of the universe as we know it is actually inside of us, isn't it? It's a kind of perceptual, this is where we are, and this is where we feel, you know, and our logical thinking brains are inside us, but also our dreaming brains and our kind of hopeful brains and our personalities, all in here and all out there at the same time. You know, it's like this kind of crazy being in two places at once, you know, quantum entanglement. I don't want to, you know, annoy the physicists or anything. But yeah, I mean, it's just the exploration itself is very expansive, isn't it?
There's a very important factor to this whole conversation that I think we need to address, though, and that is that you're in the UK, I'm here in New Zealand. We're having a very Eurocentric conversation. Okay. Because if we place ourselves in many of the indigenous communities around the world, the Maori here in New Zealand, for instance, very open to, you know, experiences such as, you know, their version of seeing Buddha in the sky. It's absolutely well known, and it's a part of reality. What you saw in terms, you know, when you say you quiet your mind and visions come to you, well, that's a vision quest, and the Native American nations have been doing that for, you know, eons. Eastern cultures, they've often talked about, like Taoism, for instance, that you were talking about the universe and how we come from the world. I mean, that's meditation, stillness, mindfulness, and getting information through, they call it your heart mind. So there are many, many, many cultures around the world where this is fully accepted. So the information that, you know, the conversation we're having now, there's a cat snoring behind me.
You can hear something in the background.
The cat snoring. Oh,
it must be comfortable.
I just think it's really important for us to be aware of where we sit in the world and culturally in terms of this information, because you and I wouldn't even be having to have this conversation if we were brought up in many Eastern cultures, or if we were raised in a purely Indigenous culture. And perhaps through us as Westerners, having this conversation, we're actually honoring the knowing and the wisdom and the experiences that many, many other cultures have every day. We've actually been dismissing a lot of their reality.
Why do you think that happened? Where did we kind of lose our way? Because once upon a time, the scientists were also magicians, you know, they were the alchemists. Mm-hmm. Were, you know, at home, they were mixing things up in, you know, over their fire, creating new chemicals, new alloys, but they were also deeply reading these kind of magical texts, and it was very deeply related to kind of spiritualism and mysticism and all that kind of stuff. And that led on to, you know, where we are today with modern science and microscopes and, you know, modern medicine, all that kind of stuff. Where do you think we kind of lost that kind of connection with these kind of psychic things, with psi, with our kind of spiritual, you know, roots, if you like?
Because I think we lost our scientific process. And I say that because science, the early scientists, like you say, were the magicians. The astrologers were the astronomers. Pythagoras was also the father of numerology. So what we did, what we used to do as humans, was experience and observe the world and then try to explain our experiences and our observations. And then Newtonian science came along, empirical science came along, which is wonderful. Absolutely. Let's take our experience and then try and test it and see how robust our theories are. How fabulous. But the problem was then, it seems to have morphed into, well, like I say, we lost our intellectual humility. And rather than experiencing the world and trying to use our empirical science to explain what we were experiencing, so Western society fell on the sword in terms of, well, no, we know what science says, and any experience outside of that is impossible, unknowable, unbelievable. Do you see? And so if we were still in the scientific method, truly, if we were still in a place where we observed and experienced and allowed those experiences and those observations to be the reality, and then came back to science to say, hey, help me explain that, then we'd have an awful lot more science around psi. We'd have a lot more science around the survival of consciousness after death. We'd have a lot more science around the idea of other lives, or the memories of other lives.
Yeah, because we lost our scientific
curiosity.
Yeah, and I think we occasionally get reminders of this. I think when we do kind of read those studies about meditation and how it, you know, they put someone who's meditating into an MRI scanner or something like that. They see how their brain is functioning. And like you said, you know, the Buddhists could have said, well, we could have told you this 2000 years ago, you know, but then, you know, you send the Hubble Space Telescope into space and our complete, you know, vision of the universe has changed. We only thought there were one or two galaxies, but now we know there are billions upon, you know, hundreds of billions of galaxies in the observable universe, as they call it, you know. And whatever happens next, they just sent the James Webb Space Telescope up, and when that is unfolded in a few months' time, we're going to be seeing even more of the universe, seeing backwards in time. And I often think, you know, how big does science have to get, you know, and how small does it get before it becomes so abstract that we do start dealing with, you know, existence on a purely spiritual level. You know, we're talking about things that are so beyond our comprehension, you know, when we're talking about the universe and things like that. How much do we have to actually fall back on the unknowable and the, you know, trust our, you know, inner voice or whatever these messages are that we're getting, that actually there are some things we just can't know, and that this is much more reassuring here.
Well, we can't know now with our 21st century mind, and I think that's what we have to bear in mind, is that any information we're filtering, whether it's empirical information or whether it's psi information, it has to be made sense of and expressed by our conscious brain. If we're going to put something into language, we have to have the words that express whatever it is that we've just seen or experienced. And I think of the Bible, full of these incredible visions, Revelations, for instance. Now there's controversy around what Revelations actually was, and maybe it was just a story actually made up by several different people and put together, but let's just hypothetically say that Revelations is real and that there are visions. There's a vision there about two brothers standing and then they disappear up into the clouds. On that terrible tragic day when the Twin Towers came down, I was reminded of that particular phrase in Revelations, and I thought, oh, that's really interesting, because from my experience, if you had a primitive peasant mind back in, you know, 2000 no Revelations 4000 years ago, and they were given a vision of these incredible buildings going up and collapsing with the cloud around it, that's probably how I'd describe it. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think we have to be aware that it's possible probably right now to get visions of a far future, but I don't think we'd ever be able to explain it, and we'd never be able to express it, because we don't have the concepts that would enable us to do so.
And I suppose the stories, you know, when we talk about, you know, the stories of the Bible, we're talking about Iron Age people, you know, the history of, you know, our current ideas about religion go back to Iron Age gods and warrior gods. And that's where the kind of stories of Christianity come from. So we're talking about, you know, you talk about intellectual humility. We're talking about people who don't have the words to express what they've just seen. So it does become a story. It becomes folklore. It becomes something that gets written into these texts. And then later on, as we become more scientific and more kind of judgmental in our empirical studies, we kind of say, well, no, that's just nonsense. That's, you know, you can't, you know, possibly believe that. But meanwhile, I'm going to go to church on Sunday and, you know, and pray. And then I'll get back to the lab on Monday morning.
But my point is, as our intellectual understanding grows, you know, in 100 years time, kids are going to be learning coding in, you know, the first year of school, because that'll just be where we're at intellectually. As that grows, I think then there's a greater understanding of all this other stuff. We will be able to understand the vastness of the universe and the composition of the universe, and is there a higher consciousness and how that works. And interesting, now there are theories starting to build now around that flips the whole composition of our material world on its head. So it's chemistry. The reason that a lot of people have problems and are believing that psiability fits into our reality is they put consciousness at the very top. So there's chemistry creates biology, you know, and so forth, and then somehow they believe that consciousness arises from our biology, that our brain creates consciousness. And then when you place it, I'm not expressing this very well because it's not, I'm not the expert in it, but when you place it in that order, there is no way for us, for our consciousness, to understand things outside of space-time. But the theories that are arising now is, hang on, but you could quite easily put consciousness at the bottom. You could say that consciousness gives rise to chemistry, which gives rise to biology. And simply by putting it that way, everything is possible. Everything that people have experienced and denied that they've experienced and been told they didn't experience, everything that we regard as psi or supernatural or paranormal is actually totally within the bounds of how, of that form of composition.
So we're always talking about a kind of universal consciousness that we're all part of, you know, that brings together all the elements to create the cell, to create the kind of neuron, to create the, you know, like almost like a kind of dark force that we haven't explored yet, you know, bringing things together. That's quite a abstract idea for me to get my head around, but I like that a lot. I like the idea that, you know, that is the, you know, nothing in the universe is happening by accident. And actually there is a kind of consciousness, whether or not it's a intellectual consciousness, but a consciousness that is kind of bringing things together,
which our Indigenous brothers and sisters have been telling us for millennia.
And I suppose as well, there's this whole idea of, you know, back in the days, and, you know, in parts of the world now where it's still kind of quite normal to talk about these kind of things, you don't need to explain it. You don't need to quantify it. You just kind of accept that, oh, that was interesting. I wonder what that means, you know, and it's, you know, becomes part of your kind of culture in a way, which possibly we've lost due to commercialism, due to, you know, capitalism, who knows, but yeah, so we're going off on a bit of a tangent now, but in terms of, you know, we talk about kind of psi and how we're kind of receiving all the time, and for some people it might come like me with my visions in my head when I'm meditating. Other people hear things, you know, they receive kind of quite obvious messages from other people over time, or from the universe, if you want to call it. How can we kind of tune in a little bit? Are there anything we can do to kind of tune into this and to listen and to hear that everything that we've kind of closed ourselves off to?
Yes. First of all, understand how your brain speaks to you. Understand how you learn. So I was really, really bad at getting any kind of psi information because I thought I was supposed to be seeing visions, and I don't. That's just not. And I'm also not very visual. I'm not a visual learner. I don't recall, I don't have a photographic memory. Everything I am attuned to in life is actually through my emotions and through hearing. I can tell you the lyrics of songs that I learned when I was 5 years old, you know, in my first day of school. So I have a very audiographic memory. Yeah. So when I get information, it's my own inner monologue that gives me the information. When I get information, I step into a room or a house and feel, sense that emotion straight away. So don't believe that there is only one way to get this information. It's coming to you in a way that suits you and the way that you see and interact with the world. Secondly, it's coming to you in the quiet. Right. If you're filling your life with your Instagram feed and Netflix and work, no, you're not going to hear it. Although half of all spontaneous sigh experiences around the world come through dreams, because you have quietened your conscious mind. So if you're someone who thinks you can't ever pick up information, ask yourself a specific question before you go to sleep, and then pay attention to any dreams if they appear. And then thirdly, the early science is starting to show that sigh flows through us as a right brain process. We understand now it's not necessarily left and right brain, but it's a right brain process. It's a flow like creativity and emotion is. So try to increase and enhance your right brain processes, become more creative, become, you know, more attuned to nature, step into the flow of life rather than the analytics of life, and you will start to strengthen that the vehicle through which your sigh information will flow.
Do you think you talked about you're in New Zealand at the moment, you're under lockdown, you've just moved house, you're under a lot of pressure, probably very tired because you're re-releasing your book. Do you think there needs to be a kind of focus on, you know, wellness? Do you think being tired inhibits your ability to pick these things up? Do you think being rested, being kind of hydrated? Because I certainly know I feel better when I've had a good night's sleep, and my cognitive abilities are better when I'm, you know, looking after myself rather than when I'm burning the candle at both ends. Do you think that kind of thing helps you kind of tune in a little bit?
I'm just taking a moment to it's a very interesting question, one I've never considered before. Certainly when I'm tired, my brain takes over. You know, when I'm tired, my anxieties kick in. Yeah. And anyone who's understood anxiety knows that the brain is on a track of its own. So yes, yeah, certainly it is a lot harder. Yeah, I think wellness, but see, wellness and stillness go hand in hand too, right? When we are running around like headless chooks, then we're not taking that time to be still and listen.
If people want to find out more about your book, where can they go to find it? And, you know, is it available online? Can they get it in bookshops? Where's the best place to go?
Absolutely. I've actually just re-released it, and it now has a new distributor in the USA, which is actually much better than it was based in Singapore. Go to infinitemindbook.com. So that's infinitemindbook.com. You can find me at kimforrester.net, and it's got everything, my podcast, the book, my consultations. And I would be delighted to connect with anyone on Instagram as well, at I am Kim Forrester.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put all those links as well in the show notes that go along with the show and everything, and on the website. And yeah, well, thank you. This is the second time we've chatted, and I love it. I really feel like, you know, we were talking about getting contracted and getting expansive. I feel very expansive after our conversation, so I'm really appreciative of just this topic and picking your brain on this really interesting subject. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris, and I'm highly energized now, which is an absolute blessing to me. Thank you.
Excellent.
So there you go, that was the fantastic Kim Forrester telling us all about sigh and encouraging us to get quiet and listen to those voices, those feelings, those otherwise unexplainable things that might actually be trying to tell us something. You can find out, as I mentioned, about Kim and her book, and that's at infinitemindbook.com. And also Kim is at her home on the internet at kimforrester.com. And she's also on Instagram. I am Kim Forrester. Next week, I'll be speaking, and I'm very excited about this. I'll be speaking with Jaya Myra about how we can use mindfulness to heal ourselves and to get better and to live better lives. So that will be a really exciting conversation. And in the meantime, check us out at conversationsonliving.com, where you'll find all of the other episodes. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get this podcast. And in the meantime, have a lovely day.